From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
There has been a general trend that has bothered me. The fact that religion has been brought so much to the fore of our political discussion these days bothers me. Mm-hmm. I don't think it belongs there. The case for a political movement or idea or individual is quite important to our democracy, quite clearly. I think it is well if we can look toward them and say, well, they are faithful to their faith, but they are not trying to force their faith upon me as a fellow member of their democracy. That is most important in my considerations.
It was January 15, 2006, that State of Belief made its debut on Air America Radio with headline guest Walter Cronkite. Walter had told me many times that if Interfaith Alliance ever did a radio show, he wanted to be our first guest. And he was. The most trusted man in America passed away just 3 years later. But his legacy and his blessing have been a part of State of Belief every week for 15 years now. So many of the concerns Walter expressed here on this show and more widely as spokesman for Interfaith Alliance have come fearsomely to pass. In the weeks ahead, we will celebrate this anniversary and share with you on the air and online many more highlights of this decade and a half, but we will also continue to highlight the great threats our nation faces today and amplify the voices of those working for a better America and a better world in 2021. A great big thank you to each and every one who has listened to, responded to, donated to, and shared State of Belief Radio. You've kept us going and given our work meaning.
Journalism has been hollowed out, and social media and conspiracy theories have swooped in to fill the void. You know, it's very important to support real journalism. In terms of social media, I would say that it's important for people to be mindful when interacting with people on social media, you know, mindful of sharing things reflexively, mindful of how you interact with other people on social media. I wonder if some people who have fallen into conspiracy theories couldn't benefit from a loving interaction from somebody that they trust in their life.
On Thursday, Interfaith Alliance gathered a panel of experts to examine the question of what brought our nation to this moment of crisis and how we might move forward together across lines of faith and ideology. The event was moderated by Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline and consisted of investigative journalist Sarah Posner, crisis management expert Fred Garcia, and Sabi Singh, past president at Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma City. Later in the show, you'll hear some highlights from this important discussion.
President Trump is the most pro-gay president in American history. I know firsthand that President Trump is the strongest ally that gay Americans have ever had in the White House.
Shocking as it is, the broader wave of bigotry and intolerance we've been subjected to in recent years has included widespread and savage anti-LGBTQI+ rhetoric, policies, and violence beyond what most of us would have thought possible. And the situation is even worse in some places overseas. We'll get a briefing from the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner, senior pastor at the Metropolitan Community Church of New York and founding executive director of the Global Justice Institute.
What really it comes down to is whistleblowers are redistributing power because they're giving you information you wouldn't have had, and information is power. It's fundamental. Conversely, those people who are able to control and contain information also retain that power.
This week, an important moral movement was launched that is incredibly relevant for the moment we find ourselves in. As so much of our public rhetoric consists of lies, the pursuit of truth has never been more important. And insiders who impose wrongdoing have never been as vulnerable. That's why we want to highlight the launch of Bearing Witness, a new initiative to engage faith leaders and communities in the work of encouraging and protecting whistleblowers in upholding democracy itself. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Monday is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. As the teachings of the civil rights legend resonate as urgently as they ever have across our land, 2 points. First, and somberly, I am reminded that this is the first observance of this day since the passing of Representative John Lewis of Georgia, who marched with Dr. King and carried on his legacy in an unparalleled career in public service before succumbing to cancer last year. Secondly, though, I note that the man who currently serves in Martin Luther King's pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, has just won a close race for a seat in the U.S. Senate, tipping the balance in that body in favor of the Democratic Party. Many of you who have been listening to this show all across the years have several times heard Reverend Warnock on State of Belief Radio. And now to our first guest. Lewis Clark is the longtime executive director and CEO of Government Accountability Project. This week, the project launched Bearing Witness, which offers free and reliable resources to clergy, faith leaders, and faith communities so they can provide responsible support and connect potential whistleblowers with experts. The fight for truth in an age of lies is never far from our minds, and so I am very happy to welcome Lewis Clark to State of Belief Radio. Lewis, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've led Government Accountability Project since 1978. What makes now the time to formally engage with faith communities and leaders?
Well, I would say all you have to do is remember what happened last Wednesday or a week ago at the Capitol. And you know that we are at a point of crisis in this nation at which the whistleblowers are absolutely critical at this time.
How is what you're doing today look when you look back when you started in 1978? What's the difference?
when I started in 1978, and amazingly, the United Methodist Church actually recognized the first 11 years of my work at Government Accountability Project as a form of ministry. So in a sense, we're going back to the roots of that engagement, because there are so many people who have a connection, or so many people who are concerned about wrongdoing in the workplace, and we believe and have seen that the faith community could be very helpful to these people, and we want to make sure to offer resources to the faith community, to clergy, and to leaders of congregations.
Hmm. Would you talk about a couple of instances where people of faith played a determining role in upholding or defending truth tellers who decided to sound an alarm about corruption or lies?
I would start with Dawn Wooten, for example, was a nurse at a detention center in Georgia who just this last summer stood up for her faith and protested that a number of the women in detention were being forced without their consent to have medical procedures, including hysterectomies, that they did not consent to. And her faith was a dominant factor in propelling her forward to speak truth to power in that instance.
Mm.
Going back for almost 30 years anyway, is Bert Barabee was the head of the National Capital Region for the General Services Administration. He was in charge of a budget of $1 billion, $1.2 billion actually. And his job was to see that the federal buildings were well maintained, including the White House, including the Capitol. And yet he was finding that resources were not adequately given to keeping these buildings safe for their inhabitants. And so therefore he stood up to the head of GSA, to actually the Reagan administration, and spoke truthfully about the problems. He was then fired. It took us, I think, 5 years of litigation, and then he was reinstated after all that time. And a critical factor in his decision-making was his relationship to his local parish and a priest in that parish who guided him through that process.
My goodness. A key part of bearing witness is the sign-on letter for faith leaders. If you would, talk about that, please.
Yes, we're actually trying, we're hoping to get people throughout the country who are faith, who are essentially faith-based believers of all denominations and all faiths, medical, and we're hoping that they will sign on to a letter of support for adequate whistleblower protections for those people within government who stand up and speak out about abuses of power, gross waste of funds, gross mismanagement, illegality, abuses of authority, and also helping to resist being ordered to do things that are illegal. We were hoping people will sign on to that. We are also hoping that people will spread the word to their communities and to their social media to let people know that there are these resources available. And there, again, the resources are for clergy and for faith communities, as well as the whistleblowers themselves who are motivated to stand up, or at least considering that because of their faith.
And how does one sign on?
Just contact the Government Accountability Project at whistleblower.org and just say the word faith. And we'll connect you to the people on our staff who are definitely committed to seeing that all people who are concerned about helping people of faith make these decisions and essentially navigate this world of whistleblowing.
Where do you see the moral authority of faith-oriented support for whistleblowers as most urgently needed now?
I think it's most urgently needed throughout government agencies in particular. We have just gone through 4 years of the most illegal administration that this country has ever experienced. We've never had a president, for example, who was so well connected to the white supremacist community and actually tried to use that community for generating support for himself. And in the process, he really corrupted all agencies throughout the government. I mean, I would say agencies throughout the government as well as departments. We've never seen an array of politicalization that occurred throughout major departments of government. And so this just needs to be reversed. And so the next 2 years for sure is going to be devoted to all those initiatives of the Trump administration that are essentially beyond the law, or certainly beyond what should happen in the government of all the people and for all the people.
You know, I think a lot of people of goodwill have been confused and even jaded by groups like Project Veritas, who pose as whistleblowers but are in fact political propaganda machines. What guidance can you offer to help discern the difference between true whistleblowing and the misuse of this time-honored practice?
I think it starts with the truth itself. Every person who comes to us for support comes, and we receive essentially thousands of people every year who actually seek our support. And the cases that we take on, we investigate them, and we make sure that what people are telling us is the truth. Now, some of the people might believe that they are essentially representing the truth, but we have to do an independent investigation to make sure and substantiate what they have to say. Groups like Veritas, they don't want the truth. What they want is essentially to create propaganda. And so they essentially are manipulating the truth. That can never happen in our organization.
Hmm. Louis, what would you like to see Bearing Witness achieve in its first year?
Oh, I would hope that we can sign 2,000 people up to essentially want to know a lot more, and also, you know, hopefully to prepare themselves so that they're ready to help people who are whistleblowers. And so that's for starters. Secondly, is we really want to know, we want every member of Congress to know that there is a movement of people of faith who are going to stand by other people of faith who are essentially bearing witness. And so we really hope that we want the message to those members of Congress to be is that we need better laws to protect people. So we need more protection for the whistleblowers.
I want to be sure we've covered all that we need to cover. What else should our listeners know about this bold initiative?
Yeah, I think that people need to know that the laws that exist, and we have been responsible for about 35 of the federal laws on whistleblowing, that despite the fact that we have maybe even adequate legislation, but it's not always implemented in the right way or effectively. And so what we really need to happen is to clarify the laws, make them even better. We hope to have jury trials on these cases and not just decisions being made by the bureaucracy. So that's one of our goals. But essentially, we would like not only better legislation, but we also would like people to know about what the laws are. And we would like to help the clergy so that when they counsel people, they'll have an adequate knowledge about what laws might be effective. And hopefully the clergy will be able to refer people to us as a resource so that we can help these people and navigate the laws that do now exist.
Lewis Clark is the longtime executive director and CEO of Government Accountability Project. As a part of its Democracy Protection Initiative, the project has just launched Bearing Witness, supporting clergy, faith leaders, and faith communities in their essential role as the persons whistleblowers often turn to first. Lewis, thank you so much for your decades of dedication to this important aspect of democracy, and thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much, and bless you for giving us this opportunity to let people know what is available to them as a resource.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, our annual check-in with the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner of the Metropolitan Community Church. And later, highlights from the Interfaith Alliance panel discussion. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gay. Every January, we get an overview of the faith-inspired struggle for social justice, as well as ministry to LGBTQI plus persons of faith that comprise the busy life of the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner, senior pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church of New York and executive director of the Global Justice Institute. With so many changes in our world, I am comforted to keep this tradition and welcome her back once again to State of Belief Radio. Pat, it is great to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks so much. It's good just to hear your voice and have this chance to check in again. So thank you very much.
As you look back over 2020, what stands out for you the most in your ministry?
Wow, what stands out the most? Well, I think what stands out the most to me is the ability of people to kind of pick themselves up and carry on and to really push forward in the midst of circumstances that were already very difficult to navigate and then became much more complicated with things like COVID-19 on the one front and, you know, the political upheaval on the other front, which I think in the United States we tend to think is just happening to us, but really there's this kind of global movement toward fascism, and I think watching people in the midst of very challenging situations, partnering with them, hearing from them, trying to support them, not give up and not lose hope has been really, really inspiring to me.
Mm. I want you to talk some more about the challenges faced by the communities in New York that you serve during the health and economic crisis of the past year.
Well, that has just been an overwhelming reality for us. The amount of people we serve in terms of food or food support has easily doubled, if not tripled. And we've managed through all of this to keep those food services running as well as our services to homeless queer youth, keep them as in-person, open, functioning services, even while we went virtual with our worship services. And again, I have to say, you know, people are very desperate, and their economic situations are really desperate. Still, you know, if you're on the food line, if you're giving out groceries, people are just so willing to share and so willing to express care and concern for us as we do this and for others. So, you know, it's been a terrible year in many ways, and it's also been one of the most reinvigorating years of my ministry.
How did the Metropolitan Community Church adapt to the restrictions and risks of the COVID-19?
Well, initially, we thought we would be able to just, you know, observe some protocols and continue to function, but we very quickly realized that in a community where many people are already immune compromised or dealing with serious kinds of health challenges, that wasn't going to be possible. So, and we also realized that of our three Sunday services, only two really translated well into the virtual world, at least given our abilities. So we went from three services to two Sunday services. We have to pre-record them and tape them because our space is such that doing like a Zoom or a Facebook Live doesn't really work for us because there's not enough space to space out the participants we would need. Our building was built in the late 1800s, so it's like 25 feet wide and 100 feet long. So we've had to just, you know, adapt that way. I think people who might not have been willing to spend the time coming in person for pastoral counseling are more than willing to pick up the phone or to Zoom chat or be on Skype. So just the whole pastoral care level has really increased. And then, of course, there's the burden, and I think you probably know what I mean, of not being able to be with people in the hospital or in all kinds of life-altering situations and having to find ways to, you know, care for them. And I think, interestingly, at least interesting to me, is how much people appreciate prayer and prayer support in this time. And, you know, every Sunday I spend several hours just texting like a one or two line blessing to all the people I have a cell phone number for. And it's amazing to me how meaningful that is to people and how much it helps them get through their week.
With all of this in mind, what have been the areas of greatest need that you've faced as a faith leader during this pandemic, as well as the Trump era?
Well, you know, I, as you mentioned, one of our big areas is Global Justice Institute. And so negotiating and engaging people and work that are the result, people who are the victims of, and work that is the result of the kind of fascism Trump has engaged. And he's not alone. I mean, I think, you know, I think of Maduro in Argentina. I think of, you know, Putin. I think of Kim Jong-un. I think of Xi in China. I mean, the world is full of people that Donald Trump emulates or who emulate him. And so people all over the world are suffering the ramifications of that. And so, you know, in the Global Justice Institute, we've been really challenged in helping people continue to stand up and fight back. It was a tough year, but for example, in Belarus, where Lukashenko has essentially stolen an election and summarily imprisoned and tortured all who stand up to him, we've managed to open, not in Belarus, but across the border in Lithuania, in Vilnius, because it's just too dangerous for people in Belarus, a field office and with some partners, including Journalists for Tolerance and a local attorney, and begun the process for legal recognition and conducted 3 training sessions virtually for journalists, in particular about homosexuality in the Bible and the dangers of reparative therapy and their practical concerns, how they can better do their reporting in a way that's more inclusive and supportive of justice. So, you know, we've managed to do those kind of things in the midst of all of this, but it has been taxing and challenging for everybody.
Well, I'm sure. What do you wish more people would understand about how life has changed for queer people of faith during 2020?
Well, I think, you know, what leading up to 2020, we could, in a very broad sense, say that the last 50 years were spent battling for equality and for just and right relationship, and that even though it went back and forth, we had made great progress, you know, progress around relational equality, progress around issues like adoption and child care, progress around health care, progress around people who wanted to serve in the military, progress around funding for our institutions, you know, progress for federal job protection, all kinds of things. And then in the last 4 years, but I think particularly in 2020, it seemed like very cruelly implemented, just the stripping away things that some of us had spent, you know, 30, 40, 50 years of our lives seeking to accomplish. So it has been, you know, one of those kind of Psalm 137 experiences, like, you know, how can I sing your praise in a foreign land, yeah, you know, when I've lost everything? And really, I think, challenging years spiritually.
I know that travel restrictions and other changes during this pandemic must have had a really big impact on the work of the Global Justice Institute. What have you been able to achieve in the face of all of those limitations?
Well, actually, quite a bit. I mean, it has been challenging, as you say, but as I mentioned, we've been able to do some very significant work in Eastern Europe, in Belarus and Lithuania, and in addition to opening the office, the field office there, we been able to provide some training to an Orthodox priest who would become part of our team. In Russia, we've been able to partner with a seminarian and his partner to safely get them out. In Armenia, we've been able to partner with a human rights defender who works with AIDS Action and Mission AIDS Development and largely focus on people living with AIDS and queer people and on positive public policy initiatives, if you believe it. In Romania, after our successful case last year with relational recognition for people married outside the country, we've continued to press the Romanian government for partnership recognition and insurance coverage for partners in same-sex relationships, and made it to the Commission on Human Rights this past year, which has agreed to hear the case, which is the first step toward getting to the Human Rights Court. So that's a very big deal. In Latin and Central America, we've appointed Reverend Elder Margarita Sanchez de Leon as our regional director, and we've been asked to serve as pastoral support for women, partnering with Catholics for Free Choice in Mexico, the safety of women and reproductive justice throughout that part of the world is a major issue. We were able to keep COMAC, an AIDS organization, up and running by the support we offered. And in Honduras, the two hurricanes really played havoc with people's lives, but we've continued to partner with Ecumenicus and support cis and trans women in their quest for, largely their quest for safety at this point. In Brazil, COVID-19 really interfered with our plans for on-site visits, but we've continued to support Sephoros, which works with trans women in the capital, and support the shelter in Moringa. We had hoped to complete the process for government recognition there, but Brazil has cut that process off. We did, however, issue a position paper on rape when the court system there decided that there was such a thing as involuntary rape. So again, women's safety will probably be a big focus for us in the coming year. In Costa Rica, we've been able to continue keeping the office we started there for refugees open, Casa Abierta, and working with our folks on the ground there. And we are working on a partnership with some Jesuits at the border of the United States, Mexico, and Texas, who have hands-on help with people. In Argentina, we participated in several panels on the right to choose, one with pastors and female theologians that presented to Parliament. We've been involved in the anti-racism movement in Puerto Rico, which is part of our effort to kind of globally connect what's going on around race in the United States, Puerto Rico, Brazil, et cetera, and to see that as a global crisis. You know, we were able to support a movement in Venezuela seeking to open a queer center. In the United States, we've continued our work with the Council for Global Equality that involved lobbying Congress and, you know, seeking to work on queer-affirming federal legislation, everything from health care to just pay to equitable vaccine distribution to federal jobs promotion, a lot of different stuff. Several cases before the Supreme Court. We were, because they held it virtually, we could be send a delegate to the Ministerial for the Advancement of Religious Freedom this year, which was situated in Poland and raised some substantial issues around Poland and its movement to create, quote, gay-free zones. We were able to partner with one foundation in Florida and provide clergy support there. In East Africa, we continued our work in Matitoande. We're developing a hothouse now and exploring more land, and we provided sanitary support for girls and helped send a student to PSR and stocking a fish pond and sent some COVID-19 relief, as well as the things we always do, like an LGBTQI affirming retreat once a year and support for the water ministry and HIV and AIDS education there. In the Caribbean, we're partnering with new leadership in Jamaica. The new leaders seem really willing to take on the sodomy laws there. In Australia, we continue to send money for the fire relief that continues to go on. And in Asia, we're hopeful about a movement in Malaysia. One of Reverend Boone's books was banned after 7 years of publication, but the queer rights leaders have decided to use that as an opportunity to challenge around human rights issues in the courts. So we're hopeful about what we can do there in the coming years. So even though, you know, we didn't get to do the in-person things we had planned to do, I think we kept our focus and were able to push forward with a lot of work.
My goodness, I am stunned at all that you have just told us about what you were doing despite restrictions. Is there a focus that you have as you go into this next year for the Global Justice Institute?
Well, I think what we're going to do in the new year, not only continue with some of these projects that we've mentioned, but in a sense turn the crisis of COVID-19 into our opportunity to expand our virtual capacities and to begin to hold the kind of meetings globally that we could never afford to do before because of travel costs, you know. So we're going to, I think, try to invest. As I said, we opened an office in Lithuania. We're going to try to open one in Mexico to serve Central and Latin America and to get the heads of these on-the-ground places, Kenya, Mexico, Lithuania, into a virtual forum where we can try to connect the dots, like I mentioned in Puerto Rico, around big issues like racism, like women's safety and equality, and see if we can't have a kind of a strategy that's more strategic globally, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. I know this has been a particularly difficult year for many donor-supported organizations.
Yeah.
How can listeners learn more about and support your work with the Global Justice Institute?
Well, you know, there's several ways. They can go to the website at www.globaljusticeinstitute.org, and there's information there. There's also phone number there. There's also drop-down sites for donations. They can always email me at revpat@globaljusticeinstitute.org. And they can always call me. I'm happy to talk to people at 212-629-7440. I'm happy to take questions. I'm happy to spend time talking about particular projects or to hear ideas other people have or to help people get connected to people on the ground that they might be able to support and help.
Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner is the longtime senior pastor at Metropolitan Community Church of New York and founding executive director of the Global Justice Institute. She is also a perennial source of inspiration as well as gratitude and a treasured friend. Pat, I'm going to ask you something I've never asked you. I don't know whether I've ever asked anybody else to do this or not, but I've just got I heard what you said about what you were doing on Sunday afternoons and calling people and just saying one line to them, a prayer for them, or a way of saying you can do this. Before we go, would you just do a one, however many words it takes, a prayer that you make for all of us as we go into this new year?
Sure. So wherever we are, let's just, in whatever way that's good for us or our practice, let's go to prayer now. God, I just thank you for the gift of life and every opportunity it gives us to abide in your grace and mercy and goodness. I pray that as we enter into the season of remembering heroes and saints and martyrs like Dr. King, that we can just hold on to the vision of a world at peace with its God-given diversity and be guided in making choices and decisions that further just and right relationship. With every breath we breathe and every word we speak and every deed we do, may some part of your promised reign unfold on this earth. We pray for this today, trusting in the name of all that's good and holy. Amen.
Pat, thank you so much for making time to be with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
You too. particularly with growing recognition of how central the American political religious right was in the attempted coup on our nation's capital, as the U.S. Congress and Senate were together and sheltering from an unprecedented siege, Interfaith Alliance brought together some leading figures on the issues at hand for a live panel discussion on Thursday. Moderated by Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline, the panel featured investigative journalist Sarah Posner, crisis management expert Fred Garcia, and Sabi Singh, past president at Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma City. Now, here are some highlights from this important discussion.
Sarah, you've been studying this phenomenon. Could we have seen this coming?
Well, I think we could have seen the attempt coming. I think the way it played out in terms of the law enforcement failure, I think that piece of it shocked everyone. But in terms of the attempt, I think we should have seen it coming. They clearly would not have been as emboldened as they were last Wednesday without Trump's validation. And the validation wasn't just his speech at the Ellipse before the siege, where he told them to go march on the Capitol and fight like hell. This has been 5 years in the making, from the moment he came down the escalator in Trump Tower and called Mexicans rapists and criminals. This is what enthralled the racist right about Donald Trump's candidacy. And he just persisted throughout his campaign and presidency in making these organizations and individuals feel like they were no longer fringe, that they were part of the mainstream.
That sort of brings me to you, Fred, and your work on lone wolf whistle terrorism.
I agree with Sarah that the event itself can't be seen in isolation. And one of the things that I study is the patterns of influence and the patterns of audience reaction to charismatic leaders. And those patterns have explanatory power, where you could look back and make sense of something, but they also have predictive power. And one of the patterns that I've noticed is Trump actually began before the escalator. He began by delegitimizing and demonizing Barack Obama. And that activated the white supremacists who previously were skeptical of Trump. And then when he came down the escalator, that got the attention of the white supremacists. And when he called for a total and complete ban of Muslims, when he called for building the wall, that got the white supremacists on board. But beyond the white supremacists who self-declare, and who, by the way, took credit for his victory, in many ways, Trump has been grooming his followers the way an abuser grooms victims, and getting them to be more and more likely to accede to accepting things that were previously unacceptable. So one of the things that I point to in Words on Fire is 12 forms of language that have historically and preceded acts of mass violence, and the patterns of how those forms of language preceded the mass violence was to condition a society to accept and condone and even commit acts of violence against groups or rivals or critics who have been demonized and dehumanized. And part of that grooming is obliterating the validity of sources of reliable information. So whether it is the news media are fake news or enemies of the people or treasonous, he has conditioned his followers to not accept the reality that others see. And so when he says they stole the election that I won in a landslide, which is demonstrably false, his followers believe it, and that creates the condition where they think they are doing something noble, but in fact, they are being manipulated by the demagogue. And the scholarship on of national security and law enforcement of how a terrorist mindset is shaped is they go through four phases. They see some social condition and say, that's not right. That intensifies into that's not fair. That intensifies into it's their fault. And then it becomes they're evil, they're less than human. And that activates people to want to take matters into their own hand. What is unique about Trump is that he doesn't lead people to those conclusions. He actually uses that language. And that intensifies and accelerates their mobilization to take action. And so when he says the vice president is going to let us down and we'll lose our country, there's this direct line between that and hang Pence, hang Pence, hang Pence.
Oh, wow. What was it that led us to this point now? Sarah, do you have a perspective on that?
Well, you know, Trump came along at the same time that we were seeing a wave of right-wing nationalist autocrats take power or try to get power across the world, you know, in Europe, in Russia, in South America. So that's part of it, obviously. I don't think we can dismiss the international dimension of this. But I think in terms of domestically, I think we got here because Trump energized and validated white supremacists and Nazis who live in America, people who belong to militias, the 3%ers. But he would not be here and we would not be here if he had not had the support of white evangelicals and conservative white Catholics and the other Christians who make up the religious right. Because if he had not had their support, he would not have gotten the nomination. He would not have had the benefit of their get out the vote operations. And I think it's really important for people to understand that the religious right stood by him and stuck with him through every moment when it was obvious that he was wallowing in the support of white supremacists, you know, from more minor moments throughout his campaign to Charlottesville to the Capitol siege. And that they played a role in brainwashing the base into believing that Trump was anointed by God, that Trump is under siege by his political enemies, and to believe in conspiracy theories that put Trump at the center of victimhood and persecution and put them in the center of playing or acting out or carrying out the idea that they are saving America, they are the true patriots, and they have to act in order to do that.
Sabi, what would you suggest that people who are watching now, listening now, need to do in order to make for better circumstances politically and in the country in general?
Well, I think what is needed in this country is what the incoming president has made his, you know, reason to be there, which is healing. After an event like this, there has to be some coming together, minimization of the conditions that caused what this was. And there's only a limited role, I understand, that the Interfaith Alliance can play in that. But I'm thinking we need to be able to focus on that issue and be able to engage people that come to our meetings, that we can interact with. And I don't mean that by having, you know, panel discussions or things like that. We need to actively go out into the community. And the mechanism, I think, that I found effective in the year that I served as president of the Oklahoma chapter was to focus on community service, which you approach as a diverse religious community. What happens is that through osmosis, through interacting with people that they normally don't meet. I mean, there were many people that met a person from a different faith or a different background, and that's what they vocalized, that this has really helped us understand while we're doing this community service, we are talking with people from different faiths, and we look at a person and see, you know, a person who you might say, who's this guy with a turban walking around? Is he from you know, so-and-so place or whatever. We now know that he's a Sikh. He's a Sikh from India.
Are you comfortable and confident in encountering people who have been in the Trump camp over these past 5 years? Do you feel that there is connection that you can make by reaching out to them?
I think so. We are all humans. And it's this process by which you get to know other people. When I came to this country, I met a number of other Sikhs who had cut off their hair, didn't wear a turban anymore. And the main reason usually was work. You know, they felt that they wouldn't get a job or they would have trouble with holding a job if they looked different. And I have found it an advantage right through my professional career and the business that I had. And I found it earlier than that. I did a month of hitchhiking. And people would stop to pick me up. There'd be 10 people lined up on the entrance to the freeway. And they would stop to pick me up because they found my looks interesting. They were people who wanted to talk to me. And so I think if you approach things at that level, that you are a human being, everybody is a human being. And I guess I have the advantage of my faith, which is a very egalitarian faith. It's not so well known in this country, but that's how my thinking has been shaped. You know, if I am approached by somebody with a gun, I would be as scared as anybody else what might happen or apprehensive about what might happen. But I don't think ultimately it becomes a factor when you get to meet people.
Sarah, you are a journalist in addition to being an author. I'm wondering what you think people listening to us now need to do in order to make things better, and particularly when it comes to news and social media?
So, well, I would say, one, when it comes to news, support your local news outlets, support your local, subscribe to your local newspaper. In a lot of communities, there are new types of newspapers and news outlets that are cropping up that are, you know, fact and evidence-based. And you should try to support them if there's one of those in your community, because one of the problems that we have right now is that journalism has been hollowed out and social media and conspiracy theories have swooped in to fill the void. In terms of the news, you know, it's very important with your pocketbook to support real journalism. And with regard to social media, you know, social media obviously has played a significant role in spreading conspiracy theories and spreading lies about a lot of different things, but right now about the election. And social media has played a huge role in spreading conspiracy theories like QAnon, which we haven't really talked about that much tonight, but also played a big role in last Wednesday's insurrection at the Capitol. So in terms of social media, I would say that it's important for people to understand how social media has played that role and to demand accountability from their elected officials to regulate social media in a way that would, contrary to what Josh Hawley might say, you know, this does not infringe on anybody's constitutional rights to regulate social media. And to be mindful when interacting with people in social media, you know, mindful of sharing things reflexively, mindful of how you interact with other people on social media. And when I say be mindful of sharing things reflexively, I mean, you know, check it out before you share it. It might be pushing your buttons. That's how social media works. They want you to feel enraged or to feel animated and to reflexively share things, and it goes against our interests in terms of truth telling and truth seeking to just do that reflexively. And I guess one more thing that I would say is that if there is someone in your life who seems to have fallen into conspiracy theories, that you should try, and you know, not try to the ends of the earth if they won't listen to you. You know, there's only so much you can do, but I wonder if some people who have fallen into conspiracy theories couldn't benefit from a loving interaction from somebody that they trust in their life.
So the answers from all three of you are the same: engage, engage, and engage. which is important.
Video of the entire panel discussion is available at interfaithalliance.org, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com, and know how grateful we are for your support. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and in company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And as I've been saying for 15 years now, be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. This is an important week ahead of us. No one knows quite what it may turn out to be. Until we meet again, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.